Okay. You're all set?
I am.
Anyway, we ran out of tape there unexpectedly. So anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, we were talking about the closing of your term as president in your Arkansas book as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, in fairness, it's not a great book, okay?
I like it.
No, it's not. I mean, and I understood the reader's difficulty with it. You know, the first three chapters are pretty good. The two chapters on the American period are not. They could have been usefully conflated, but there wasn't. I mean, the reader's report wasn't. I mean, it's quite clear that there was not going to be any effort to try to work with the book. You know, so that's fine. That was their judgment. So, but. I kind of thought I'd been sandbagged, you know.
Invited and then disinvited.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, I remember, I can't imagine. I'm sure it'll be great. And then, not really.
So you finished up your terms as president. And by the way, in the society, were there set terms? How is it that you...
They're two-year terms.
Two-year terms.
And usually the president gets two, as I said, unless... Mm. And usually it was the...
Unless you're impeached.
Yeah, unless they're impeached or people get mad at them for changing their journal or something. Board meetings were long. I remember that. They were long and tedious. The agendas were long.
And what were the agendas?
Oh, it's just all about membership and publications and finances, you know. There are lots of reports from committees and officers' reports and discussions, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a large group. I mean, there were a dozen, 15 people on it, maybe, every one of whom had a lot to say, all of it good.
And they would meet in connection with the annual meetings?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that's a tradition that continues.
Yeah, there were, I think, that, you know, my recollection is the meetings were 3 hours, probably. I wasn't too good at meeting then, I'm still not. I was pretty good at moving things along, but I'm not too good at meeting. Maybe that's just one quality.
So you shared with me and with the society your closing remarks as you were exiting the presidency, and you've completed your terms.
Oh, right, the address to the society, State of the Society in 1985. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just happened to find that just 2 days ago. Wasn't looking for it. It was serendipitously right before you came, so...
Well, I think in terms of the society's history, it's a fabulous document to have.
Yeah, it's a useful synopsis, and reading it over, I have to say, I thought it was pretty good.
And in that, among other things, you emphasized that Law and History Review was in good shape.
Yeah, already. It's only been publishing 2 or 3 years, and I said I'd spent a nice afternoon reading through all the other journals. There were then, at the time, at least four specialized journals in legal history in England and in Europe and in the United States. And I made a point of sitting down with all of them and read through them all for the previous year. It's quite obvious to me that ours was the best in terms of quantity and quality. So I couldn't have been more delighted. As I said, I know I didn't do it, but I'd like some credit at least for being a reasonably good midwife.
And I think you mentioned also that it was beginning to at least achieve a good variety of subject matter.
Yeah.
Diversity.
Yeah, I noticed. I said I guess maybe the first issue was not as diverse as it could have been, and there was some concern about that. But yeah, it had developed. It may be that at first it wasn't as attractive a venue for certain kinds of legal history as it became. So now, I'm quite sure it's a premier journal. I'm sure it's hard to get an article published in that journal with all the legal historians there are.
I aspire to that one day.
Uh-huh. And,
publish in the journal.
And, you know, and the law reviews are not all that hospitable to legal history, and there are huge numbers of legal historians, so I would imagine this was probably a long waiting line for it. It's just a guess. I had sent out a letter... Or I drafted a letter to send out to the membership about the inaugural issue, I guess it was, and about how the journal was going to be, would soon establish itself as the premier journal of its kind in the world. And I guess Charlie Donahue. Yeah, Charlie Donahue was president, vice president. He was another very important person to the society in the early days. And he called me on the phone about the draft and said, "Sounds like the hard sell from Arkansas to me." So I didn't take too kindly to that. So in my, I reported that in my address here and said that I wasn't used to being accused of hucksterism, and that I, as soon as I hung up from Charlie, I'd gone back to my closet at home to see if any plaid suits had been insinuated into my wardrobe. But I took the offending member out. I lopped it off. Coach Charlie didn't like it, but as I said in my talk, I'm sorry I did, because it turned out to be true. And why shouldn't we be proud of that?
Were you succeeded by Charlie?
No, Charlie didn't. He became president, but he didn't want to be president, as I recall. I believe that's right. I think he became president a long time later, maybe 20 years later.
Mm-hmm. And I think you would have had a lot of scholarly interests in common, at least in property and...
Yeah, we were, Charlie's a vastly more learned fellow than I am. He's a comparatist. He's a Roman lawyer in addition to being a really good English legal historian. My civil law is rusty. Not rusty. That presumes that you knew some. It's just not very, very sophisticated.
As an aside, I had both Roman law and English legal history with Charlie Donahue when I was in law school.
Oh, you're lucky.
I was.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary person. And he wrote some good stuff on landlord and tenant even. Really learned fellow.
So this coincided, the address, your valedictory and state of the society, with your accession to the bench.
Almost, yeah. I got appointed... in I got appointed in December of 85, so this may have been actually, I may have given this talk while I was, I forget the, it was 85, wasn't it? Does it have a date on it?
You mailed it in January of 86, so
yeah,
yes.
But yeah, which was just right after I was appointed.
Yeah, it is 1985, State of Society.
It doesn't say the date. It's October, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I had been nominated but not confirmed. So I was hopeful.
So you had to be on your best behavior.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I had to act nice. I did.
So you were appointed
uncharacteristically.
To the Western District of Arkansas, United States Federal District Court.
Right, where I served for 7 years. I had... I had three divisions I had to take care of on a regular basis. I rode an old-fashioned circuit, and three other divisions I had to visit on an irregular basis occasionally. So it was, and it's 6 or 8 hours across the district by car. So it's quite, you know, it's a difficult job, the hardest job I ever had. So I did that for 7 years and then got, I won't say elevated, translated to the Court of Appeals.
Your first appointment was under President Reagan,
mm-hmm.
and then second appointment to the Eighth Circuit by the first President
George Herbert Walker Bush.
And the differences between district court judge and appellate court judge are like
night and day, I'd say.
Cats and dogs.
Night and day. I mean, being on a court of appeals is kind of a treadmill, but it's infinitely easier in a sense that you don't have all this day to day administrative stuff and. Dealing with lawyers and judges, clerks and witnesses and court security officers and magistrate judges and probation officers and bankruptcy judges and traveling and, you know, never knowing where you're going to be, never knowing exactly what you're going to do when you're on the bench having to, you know, Chief Justice Roberts compared judges to umpires. Well, I have a different baseball analogy. It's really like standing in front of an automatic pitching machine. He's thinking of the appellate judge more than the real judge. For a real judge, it's not that you're not umpiring. You're being thrown curveballs and sliders and changeups, and you're expected at least to take a cut. And if you take, you know, the wrong cut, some smart aleck in St. Louis a year later might say, oh, well, that's not quite right, you know. So it's tough. Being on the Court of Appeals is a lot more leisurely. It's not leisurely, but it's less chaotic. Mm-hmm. And you know where you're going to be and what you're going to be doing.
Even if your geographic spread got a lot larger.
Yeah, but you didn't have to, you had to travel to one place a month. Mm-hmm.
And
it's usually the same place.
St. Louis or St. Paul.
St. Louis, mostly St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Twice a year, maybe in St. Paul.
So when you joined the Eighth Circuit, your brother, Judge Richard Arnold, was already on that court. And I think the two of you being on the same court made some history of its own.
It was the first time in history and also probably the last, because Congress has now made it impossible. We called it the Arnold Bill when it passed, although it really wasn't, we weren't the catalyst for it. It was Willie and his mother, Betty Fletcher, out on the Ninth Circuit that got everybody stirred up. So it's no longer possible for people within a certain degree of consanguinity or affinity to serve on the same court mm-hmm. at the same time.
Did your brother share interests in legal history as well?
Not really. No, he wasn't all that interested. In fact, he told me one time, in a rare fit of candor, he didn't really even think it should be taught. he thought law school ought to be more of a professional school. He thought all this newfangled stuff, including legal history, which I thought of as kind of old-fangled, it wasn't at the top of his list.
So you served how many years as an active judge then on the Eighth Circuit?
I served, let's see, 20 years. Not as an active, and senior. It's hard to remember. Over 20 years, 22 years, something like that. I served all together 29 years on the district court and the Court of Appeals. So over 20 years on the Court of Appeals, but seven of those were senior, as a senior judge. I have a very exalted status. You know, the federal judges have all these different rabbit holes they can jump into that are retirement or like retirement. I'm now what's called an inactive senior, which means I don't do anything. I finally found something I excel at, doing nothing.
I understand you were also appointed by Chief Justice Roberts to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance
Court of Review, correct. Yeah, the FISCR. I hate acronyms, but...
As the presiding judge.
No, I was appointed first as just a plain old garden variety vanilla member of the court. There are only three people on the court. And then when the presiding judge went off, it's a term of 7 years, and you can't re-up under the statute. When the presiding judge went off the court, I was as the next senior, the more senior of the two remaining, I got to be the presiding judge. Just a testament to having survived, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice, high-sounding title, but the truth is I wasn't too busy.
And what was... When you were busy, did that include, did you need to travel?
Mm-hmm. We sat on a case in Providence, Rhode Island one time, published an opinion, I think it was 2007. You have to have a special courtroom. It has to be, I forget, there's another acronym, but it has to be a XYZ facility before you can sit in it because
something
of the secret nature of it.
That you could contain the Ebola virus inside.
Exactly. It's got to be lead lined and bulletproof, soundproof and all that. So, but there wasn't much traveling.
Well, I'd like to talk.
I had a secret office in my chambers with a secret fax and secret telephone, that was operated, it was a secure phone, and a safe, mm-hmm. all that kind of paraphernalia. So, that was what I was supposed to operate out of most of the time. secure facility.
Secure.
With curtains, that you know, you can't have even have open windows because there are, I won't bore you with this, but there are devices available that allow espionage by just electronically beaming some kind of beam through a window, which is capable of reconstructing everything in the room and sending a picture of it back, including the computer screen you're reading. Yeah. It's pretty bizarre. Yeah. Scary stuff.
But that's, you've concluded that service.
I'm off that.
I want to talk about your publications. We sort of touched on them lightly in earlier parts of our talk. They fall into two general areas, I believe.
Yeah, very disparate.
English legal history, and I think particularly the 14th century, and then colonial Louisiana. But going back first to the English legal history, this seems to be the earlier part of your publishing career.
Uh-huh.
And what were some of the, do you have a favorite publication? Or?
Oh, you know, I remember the first one I did was with John Baker, who's now a very famous English legal historian. It was just a little piece in the All Quarterly Review, I think, the LQR. I didn't publish that much. I only two or three things of any significance at all. But two things I did were two lectures. One was a very early 1974 talk I gave, I think, at the American Society for Legal History on jury trials in the medieval period, about law and fact and separation of law and fact. And that one that one attracted a lot of attention. It continues to be cited and beat up on, which is a sign of affection.
A sign of attention?
Yeah. That's been sort of, people have been trying to dismantle that one for years. I don't think they've succeeded totally, but it's interesting. And then later I gave the Kroski lecture. This would have been 15 years later at the University of Chicago on trying to develop an ideology of medieval tort law. And that one actually earned a book-length response from none other than my good friend and former teacher, old teacher, as they say in England, Toby Milsom, who gave some lectures at Columbia, and it was published, I think the title was something like A Natural History of the Common Law. But it was a response, essentially, to why I'd said, but I was never mentioned. It was very gentlemanly. My lecture, which was a good deal shorter, I had really been talking about a lot of Toby's ideas, but I never mentioned him by name either because I thought it would be impolite. You know, I didn't want him to think that I was not. I mean, I have so much respect for him. It's huge. And he was my teacher and my mentor, and I just, you know, I was very careful not to. I mean, I was assiduously avoided trying to create any kind of rift. Mm-hmm. It was just a kind of a riff on some of the things that he was saying. And so it was really quite an extraordinary exchange where we never mentioned each other. Of course, he demolished what I had to say, and I wrote a blurb on the back. It was published by Cambridge, I think. No, it's Columbia, I guess, one of the two, one of those. And I wrote a blurb on the back saying, you know, it was profusely, I praised it profusely and said it was sure to become the standard account. And I think it has. You know, he was so, but I think maybe the one that might last for a little longer, you know, nothing that's going to be very long lasting. I realized that was my Selden volumes in 1985 and 88, and particularly the introduction in 85, because it's sort of a solid doctrinal review of the law of torts of the 14th century with case illustrations. Although there's a certain amount of legal processy stuff in there too about jury control devices and precedent and that sort of thing. It's basically a kind of doctrinal account of what was going on in the king's courts by way of tort law in the entire 14th century. I read over a million entries or scopus. I looked at, you know, I would only stop at the ones that were obviously relevant, but it took me years. I started to work on that book, thinking about it and planning it with Toby Milsom in 1969.
And that's as you were completing your SJD?
Yeah, exactly. Or 70, and the second volume didn't appear until 88. So I worked on it, not obviously continuously, but over a period of almost 20 years.
That took some extensive traveling for archives?
Yeah, I spent part of every year between 69 and 85 in England. Every year, sometimes a whole year, mostly summers, but part of every year. And a lot of it was devoted to turning out those two volumes. So I was just being a harmless drudge. That's your drudgery. So maybe that will be a contribution drudges make.
And you developed a friendship with John Baker in this process?
He's a very good friend, yeah. In fact, I'm the godfather for one of his daughters. He used to stay with me when I was a graduate student in England. He used to stay with me on Monday nights. He was teaching at University College London, but he needed to get back. He was the Squire Law Librarian at Cambridge. And I guess, I forget why, but there's some scheduling difficulty between London and Cambridge. I guess he would come down the night before, maybe, and stay with me. But so we spent a lot of time together.
And how did you first come to each other's attention, through scholarly correspondence?
You know what? I think probably Bill Butler introduced us. Bill Butler was another guy that hung around the basement of Langdale in the late 60s. He was a research associate or something. Very productive guy. He'd already published a book, I think. Maybe Harvard had published it by the time I knew him. He's the world's leading expert on Russian law now. I guess he published 30 books. But Bill and I ended up together in London at the same time. And we shared a container for our books to be shipped to England. And we lived next door to each other. And Bill was at UCL, was at University College London, where Baker taught. So I'm sure that he had something to do with, that John had something to do with me and John. Sorry, Bill had something to do with me and John getting together. Yeah.
So we will have a copy of your resume, with your permission, of course, attached with the oral history. And we can't possibly go through all of the publications, but very impressive, the continuation after leaving academia in terms of your publications. And I think they tended to focus more recently, or at least within the last decade or so, on colonial Louisiana history.
30 years. Well, I published my first colonial Louisiana thing in 81, and I continue to publish. Well, I don't know. You know, I published my last Arkansas book in 2000. Anyway, I'm still working. You saw something on my desk that I was working on. I must have published something in there after that. Anyway, they don't really have any connection except my interest in documents. I mean, the English legal history is totally disconnected from the colonial Louisiana stuff. And the colonial Louisiana stuff has drifted away from legal history into more social history and history of interracial relationships between French and Indians. So it's much more social than my old stuff. But the only thing the only tether is that I'm still a documents guy. I think capital T, truth, and capital B, beauty, are to be found in documents. These guys that just kind of, you know, skip over learning the languages and don't spend the time, the hard work, get their hands dirty in the archives, I've got no use for them.
And where do you find these?
That was the thing. See, when I came back to Arkansas, I'd already had this fetish about reading documents, right, because I spent all this time in London. So, I mean, I started casting around for something to read. I mean, I essentially eventually had figured out I had to go to Seville and Paris So I did. I've been to at least six or seven archives in France, and mainly one archive in Spain, in Seville. And I found thousands and thousands of pages of letters written to, from, and about Arkansas Post, a little settlement here during the 18th century. Still extant letters, reports, and that sort of thing that nobody probably ever read in the last century, if then, some indexer. So I thought, well, this is an incredible treasure trove, because here's a whole state, the colonial history of which has never been written. So I got three books out of that and probably a dozen articles.
So you occupy the field.
Well, you know, there are other people, believe it or not. I frequently say that I'm the leading historian of colonial Arkansas because I'm the only such historian. But there are a few other people who have done some really good things. Recently, there's a woman named Kathleen Duval who has written a bigger book than I could ever write, including the Arkansas region, which is really, really good. So she's a real historian. She's great.
Well, of all the awards and honors that we won't have time to go through here, I think one of the ones most relevant to the work we were just talking about is the French government awarded you something that I cannot pronounce.
Yeah, the Chevalier de l'Ordre de Pam Académique.
That's what I meant to say.
Yeah, Knight of the Order of the Academic Palms.
For your...
Gave me a medal, too.
Oh, for your colonial work?
Uh-huh.
For the...
Yeah,
what would
I got
become
a plaque
the...
and a medal, so something the society never gave me. They did give me a party once, though, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're
going
to try to give you a copy of the subscription to Law and History
Please.
Review. Apparently, we'd like to...
Yeah, the French government guy, the consul, came up here, and we had a ceremony, and I had to respond to... He just kissed me on the cheeks three times, presented a medal, and I had to respond in French, so it took me a while to get that going. I read French well, and I can write it given some time, but speaking is difficult.
Although the pronunciation sounded...
Well, I wasn't doing very well at it. My Arkansas is better than my French.
There are other oral histories that we can refer the society to. And I believe you mentioned University of Arkansas.
There are two things. You asked me about that in writing, and I was thinking about it. There's a 30-minute show that... a biography of me that the Arkansas Educational Television Network did, AETN, and played and occasionally still plays. This is embarrassing. It's part of their series called Men and Women of Distinction, okay? So, I mean, I'm not that, but that's what they put. That's a series I'm in. And it's a, you know, professionally produced 30-minute documentary, essentially.
And I believe it's available on the AETN
Probably.
Website.
If you can't find it, I have a very few copies left if you want me to send you one. And then what's called the Pryor Center for Oral History at Fayetteville. Senator David Pryor and Barbara Pryor gave a lot of money to the University of Arkansas for an oral history center. And they have a new building now, I think, or new facilities and a big mobile unit. And they go around the state. They came to my house and did 8 hours worth of video, and they have highlights, I believe, now posted on their website.
So the Pryor Center at University of Arkansas would be the point of contact for anyone who wished to have the 8-hour version.
Well, I don't know if all 8 hours are up or not. I know excerpts are. There may be the whole unedited thing might be available, too. But I'm sure they make it available. But I don't think anybody wants to listen to that much. It may not have been that much, but I think it was. I did a legal part. Bob Brown of the Arkansas Supreme Court did the legal part. And then the history part was done by a fellow named Joe Key, who teaches at Arkansas State and has done some good work on French colonial Quapaw interactions in Arkansas. That's what he did his PhD on. So there's a kind of two-part there, lawyer, historian. So,
well,
yeah.
I think we may have exhausted your patience.
Not at all.
But are there any other areas you want to
Yeah, I have a speech I'd like to make about the changes in legal history, if you've got a minute.
Please, I would love to hear it.
Well, I noticed that Lawrence Friedman dilated on that subject, where he said that, you know, when he got to be, he came to legal history, it was all about the statute of uses and it was boring. That the subject had broadened out subsequently. He's quite right about that. But I think it's kind of a caricature to say that English legal history was just about property law. I mean, and to say that it was just totally cranky and antiquarian. I mean, if you think of Pollock and Maitland's book, for instance, I mean, Maitland's work was superb. And in fact, I think Pollock and Maitland is probably the best book that the Cambridge University Press ever published. And that's saying some, especially since it was, what, over 100 years ago. So, yeah, but he's right. I mean, things broadened out, as I was at some pains to say. So, you know, the camera pulled back, and you got to see a lot more of the sausage factory. But not only did the camera pull back, it also panned to the left because, you know, partly because it started including real historians, a lot of whom had Marxist influences anyway, and partly for other reasons, namely, for instance, that all of this change was generated in the 60s when there was a lot of ferment, social and political ferment. What you got is a lot of stuff that was being written by collectivists and statists and Marxists and people generally on the left that was, you know, a lot of it was sort of anti-capitalist and rather adolescent, really, in its anti-corporate animus, populist, you know. I mean, when was the last time you read a legal history piece that had anything nice to say about capitalism in particular or private ordering in general or contract or property, you know? Most of it is full of exploited tenant farmers and oppressed workers. And a lot of it has become captive to what's become the new history, too, which emphasizes the iron triangle of race, class, and gender. So not all of it. In fact, the last issue I saw of the Legal History Review, which was some time ago, as I've been some pains to say, was surprisingly free of that. So, you know, I'm used to reading real history now a lot more than I am legal history, and I see that a lot more in what I call real history, no offense to legal history, than I do on the legal history side, probably. But still, a lot of that became evident, and a lot of that kind of mindset became evident in the 60s and 70s and continued into the 80s in the writings of legal historians. So, yeah, it's fair. It's what is being produced now is a lot better. But it's also, in my view, kind of skewed. I kind of like to see, I kind of like to see a little more balance in the political approach. But it certainly is an improvement over what was being done and way beyond anything I could do. I don't pretend to be in hold myself out as in any way superior, but it's just kind of an observation by somebody who's become kind of a bystander since I many years ago fell from grace and became a government worker.
And maybe
so that's my speech.
But maybe it's also generational in the sense of who training others, and so you have a generation that's grown up with training under a certain paradigm of approaching.
Yeah, and I think that paradigm is pretty well, I think it pretty well owns the humanities. And to the extent legal history is part of the humanities, and I've been in some pains to say it's really moved in that direction considerably, then I think that paradigm is still in control and is likely to be. But that's for another generation to worry about.
Well, I certainly appreciate you adding your thoughts about legal history in general.
Yeah, I wasn't going to let let the opportunity go by. Mm-hmm. There might be two people who will watch this.
Even more will read the audio transcript, yeah. I suspect. So any other anything else you'd like
to do? I think I'm done. Thank you. I want to thank you for doing this. Well, it's a lot of trouble. You had to come from Atlanta and spend the night and go back. I mean,
pleasure is mine. This is a wonderful opportunity for us at the Society to memorialize some of its early history.
Great to see you, and thanks for that wonderful book you did on my brother, a copy of which I hope you notice is in my shelf.
I did. I saw it in there. Thank you.
I didn't put it in there for this occasion either. It's been in there since it was published.
Affirmation is always good. So anyway, thank you very
much.
Yeah,
you bet, Polly.
And thanks to our
thank
videographer.
You. Thanks, James.
This is the end of the interview with Morris Shepherd Arnold.